In 2009, in the depths of what we now call the Great Recession, KCUR did a series of interviews about how the economic downturn was affecting people's lives. The series was called My Two Cents, and each little segment told one person's story. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we're going to hear how some of those stories have panned out almost a decade later. One of my favorites was about Brent Vopel. He'd started selling kettle corn as a college student, trying to scrape together some pocket money on the side. Well, that became his main gig when he lost his job in the recession. Here he is at his kettle corn stand back in 2009.
I got laid off, and then I took a job that I just really didn't like. So I started looking for other jobs, noticed there just wasn't a whole lot out there. So I was like, I've got to do something. The recipe is not extensive. It is popcorn, sugar, and oil.
My name's Thomas Engler. I like kettle corn because it's simple, everyone loves it, and it's, I don't know, it's the spirit of entrepreneurship.
Thomas just moved back from Spain. He spent some time over there. He's currently looking for a job as well. He popped kettle corn with me about 4 years ago, so I was like, hey, let's go pop some kettle corn. He's like, yeah, I'm all about it. We were talking last night. We were like, let's just keep doing this until we find the perfect job, you know? It's like, why not, you know? We're kind of our own bosses, and we can leave when we want, go when we want, and it's just nice feeling to be in control for once. We're kind of rogue businessmen, you know? Rogue kettle corn maker.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and now, a decade later, the rogue kettle corn maker in chief is here in the studio to tell us how it all turned out. Brent Vopel, good morning.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Obvious first question, are you still making kettle corn?
No, I am not. Well, first of all, thanks for having me back. I feel like you guys are checking on me, so I appreciate that. But I moved on from the kettle corn business. I actually did find a really good job after that. Did that for a couple years, and then was able to start the business that I'm running now, which is in real estate and property management.
So backing up, I mean, what you told us back then was that you would just keep doing that until you found the perfect job.
Yeah, I don't know if that exists. I think doing what I was doing out there and doing what I'm doing now is what I was supposed to do. Maybe I was chasing something that wasn't there. But I really didn't.
I want to talk to you more about that,
yeah,
actually.
Go ahead.
You think the perfect job doesn't exist, which seems to me like maybe something that has changed in you in the last decade, which may have nothing to do with the recession, but I'm still interested in it.
Well, I guess there's difficulties with any job, and even as the business owner, you know, there's always challenges in life and anything you do. So perfect maybe doesn't exist. I mean, if people strive for that and try to get to that place, and we work really hard at doing that at Vopel Property Management, Canopy Road Real Estate today, but maybe perfect doesn't exist. I don't know.
Remind me about the job you'd been laid off from.
So I graduated with a marketing degree emphasis in marketing, and it was a job as a senior project manager at an advertising agency. That's what I thought I wanted to do my whole life, was be in advertising. And I really, truly loved it. And it was a company I felt like I did a lot of work for. And it was just heartbreaking to lose that and then to wander around for a little bit.
Can you tell me more about what you loved about that job in advertising management?
Teamwork. It was just a fun environment, creative environment. Everybody worked hard and worked together, and that's what I was. I think that's what I missed the most about losing that. And it's the thing I work at every day in my own business to make sure it's a good place to work and people enjoy going there every day.
You had wanted to be in advertising your whole life. And so it's interesting to me that when you did start up your own business, it wasn't in advertising.
I feel like I am in advertising. I mean, we advertise our business every day. I took a lot from those experiences working with all those great people I worked with along the way. So we have a marketing department. We are doing advertising every day. It's just one of the many challenges that we have.
How did that period of kind of wandering around, as you put it, how did that shape the direction everything took after that?
Well, I first of all, I appreciate that I have this company and that I'm able to do this every day. I think not having a purpose there for a little while and wandering around makes you really appreciate what you have when you find it, I guess.
Appreciate going to work even if there's no such thing as a perfect job?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm still passionate about it. It's still a challenge for us every day. And you go to work with the thought that you can make it perfect. And I think that mentality is good to have in business.
Can you tell me a little bit more about where you were emotionally when you didn't have that? Because some people would see their relationship to job being about a purpose, but some people might not.
I don't know how to, can you ask that again?
What did it mean to you to not have a job, at least to not have a job in the field you had planned on having one? I mean, you were popping kettle corn.
Well, it was tough. Those jobs just didn't exist for a little while. I mean, everybody got tight, and during an economic downturn, the first thing that you lose is some of your marketing budget, which means you cut back on your spend and your advertising agency business. So it was tough. You know, I would say, I think it helped, you know, like you said, it helped shape where I am today, and kind of helped me grow a little bit.
What do you hear from other people in the advertising industry who also got laid off around that time? I mean, do you know what they've done, where they've landed, whether they've landed?
Well, I think this is a big advertising agency town, and I think there's a lot of companies thriving here, and it seems that all my friends from back in the agency world are doing well. In fact, some have went on to start their own companies like me, and some of those companies are in advertising and production. So it's just I think the advertising agency here, advertising industry here, and just business in general in Kansas City is much better than it was 10 years ago.
Do you remember your last day popping kettle corn?
God, I do not. I know my son popped kettle corn this weekend with my parents. They do in Palmyra, Missouri, back home. They do kettle corn every year for the fair. So my son popped kettle corn recently, but I don't remember. I don't remember my last day. I still may do it in the future. I mean, I don't think my last day's over in kettle corn. I truly, truly love it. And it's kind of a family business for us. So,
but right now, a once a year for the fair kind of thing?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, that's okay.
And so if you enter uncertain times again, you'll bust out the kettle
corn
there again.
Yes, it is safe. I know exactly where it's at. It is ready to go at any time. And so, who knows? I think everything's going well now, and the business is going well. But hey, it's a plan C or D or E or something like that. It's there.
You are involved in a mentorship program. Can
Sure.
you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'm a first year mentee, is what I'm called, through Helzberg Entrepreneurial Mentorship Program. It's an organization here in Kansas City that pairs new business owners with experienced business owners. So every mentee has a mentor to guide them along the way. These are these are Kansas City heroes, people that have already been successful in their lives and want to give back to people that are trying to do the same. So it's going really well. Barnett Helzberg is one of the founders. He's still there today. And it's a great program for anybody that has a, it's not really for new businesses. It's for businesses that are kind of wanting to take it to the next level. So
that sounds awesome. But I do wonder, you know, you talk about the value of having someone to show you the way. It seems like that's so useful now, but how useful might it have been when you were in between things, having no idea what was going to come next?
Yeah. I think I've always had mentors throughout my life. I think, you know, my parents, my family, past employers, football coach, you know, I've had great people throughout my life that have mentored me. So it's not, this is just another relationship.
Well, Brent Vopel, it is great catching up with you.
Thank you so much. I appreciate coming on.
Call 816-235-2888 if you have a story about what happened to you in the Great Recession and whether that story is safely in the past or if you're still kind of living it. 816-235-2888. Now let's check in with someone else we heard from back then. Peter Barrett, is with us. And Peter, remind us of what you'd been doing when the recession hit.
At the time, I was the marketing director for a radiology firm in Kansas City.
And then what happened?
The local hospitals bought out that independent freestanding radiology company. And when they did that, they didn't need, I was redundant to the hospital's marketing directors. So the position was eliminated.
You were looking for work when we talked in 2009, and work in your field was hard to find, especially without leaving Kansas City, which back then you were not willing to do. Let's listen back to what you said about your situation back then.
I'm not being that picky, other than to say I want to be able to have a job where I can manage folks, mentor folks, and do things that I would do for free if I could get away with it. That's all I really need, and to be able to stay here. And I've just had grandchildren move here about 3 months ago, which really, really solidified my decision not to leave. And I've been very fortunate. I mean, I spent my time in the television industry was like getting paid to have fun. It got a little more rugged in the last few years, only because of the pressures that were just beginning to be exerted on the industry. And I'm not willing to believe that isn't possible again.
So, Peter, what are you doing now?
I work for a TV station in Champaign, Illinois, a CBS affiliate here.
So you did move away.
Excuse me?
You did move away.
Yes. At that time, I'm listening to that soundbite. That was really took me back. But my daughter went away to college, went to KU. So her life was started. And my grandkids had moved back to Cincinnati. So I was much less anchored there, although after 23 years there, I would have preferred to have stayed there. But the call of video and television was very strong in my life.
Yeah, that's what you had done before working for that radiology firm.
Yeah, in the radiology firm, I after 3 years there, I created a network in the waiting rooms of the locations, and I hired my old coworker from KCTV, Ann Peterson, to be the spokesperson, which put us on the map immediately. In the last year there, I spent a lot of time building that network, and when that job was eliminated, I realized, that's what I should be doing, is continuing to build upon my 25 years in local television. So I created my own video business after the job at the radiology firm came to an end.
How did that end up parlaying itself into the gig you have now? I mean, was it a fast and smooth process, or was there some real struggle involved?
Well, your first question, it prepared me. It couldn't have prepared me any better for this position. Because in Kansas City and in Cincinnati and Washington, D.C., my prior TV stations, I was a manager in a union environment where I did virtually no hands-on, except in a dire emergency. And when I left KCTV, I had to relearn the tools of the trade in a computer environment because I had come from an analog environment. And so I bought some fairly antiquated but still computer-based systems and went out and retaught myself on my own. So that was a process, but I did figure it out. And the second part of your question is about how difficult it was. I was doing what I like to do anyways. The difficult part was just getting any traction and getting clients to come to the business.
What kind of clients were you looking for?
Well, I was looking for anybody who would pay me at first, but I ended up doing pretty much anything. I was voice talent quite a bit. I did a lot of on-camera commercials. I did a tremendous amount of not-for-profit videos for local churches and not-for-profit organizations. I would do birthday videos, special event videos. And this is all out of the basement of my house in Lenexa. And after a few years, I started to get enough clients so I could move to out of my house and into a building that actually had offices and a studio.
When you were talking about earlier the what drew you to the job in Champaign, Illinois, you said the call of television. I mean, were you feeling the call of television as you were in your basement working on birthday videos?
Oh, it was so strong, you couldn't believe it. And that always tells me that I'm doing what I should be doing, because it's the kind of thing, as I said in that soundbite, I would have done for free anyways, unfortunately, I did it for free a lot, trying to build my business and get the word out that I was good at this. It's a powerful, anybody that has a career that they love, they've got that call to do that thing. And it was just unavoidable in my case.
How do you look back on your experience in the recession now? I mean, what are some of the big lessons that jump out to you or realizations, understandings?
There was quite a bit of it. It really forged you in fire because of the difficulties in building a business. And then, because I would do clients fast and furious as they came in. And when I wasn't doing that, I realized I was working 7 days a week just to try to pay the bills. And I wanted to find, especially in the down times, I would look for work. And at first, not in television, just leveraging my management skills. And
why not in television? Ability. Was it just the state of the television business at that time?
I know. But it's a youthful business. And at that time, I was 57. And I knew, and I'd been out of the business since 2001. And that's a long time to be out of the business. And I didn't think it was overly likely that I'd get another whack at it. I bounced back and forth between the business and applying for jobs. The business and applying for jobs.
Well, Bill, I'm so glad to, Pete, I'm so glad to hear that things are working out for you now.
Could not be better. I'm doing exactly what I said in that soundbite. I am in a position where I can mentor young people, and I can leverage the skill that is unique to me in that my decades in television, as well as my ability to manage, because I had many mentors like Bill before me. I can tell you their names right off the top of my head: Dave Abramson, John Rose, and Kobe Cooper. And I'm trying to be just as good. I'm trying to be at least as good as those guys in launching new careers and watching them blossom. And I get a tremendous thrill out of it.
I'm curious. Is it your sense that other people in Kansas City who worked in the local television industry that they have bounced back as you have, even if they didn't move away?
Yeah, I think pretty much everyone did once the economy picked up, whether it was in television or not. In 2008, it was extremely dire, and we all kind of banded together to help each other to get back on our feet as we left television for one reason or another. And And since I left Channel 5 in 2001, right up until I left Kansas City, we were all helping each other out.
Well, Pete, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you.
And now I'm going to go to a caller. We've got Bill calling us in Leawood to tell us his recession story. Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you, Laura?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. I had started a business when I was barely 26 in 1994 in Olathe, Kansas. It's a very complex business, laboratory testing. I worked for Ewing Kauffman at Umarion Laboratories, and that gave me the confidence to start the business. I only had $8,000. I needed $400,000. And I read this book. It's called Starting on a Shoestring. So I went and started this business and took it to $3 million from $8,000 in over 5 years. And five departments in Olathe, Kansas, and thought I did everything right. And then right around the election of Barack Obama in 2008, the bank got shut down by the FDIC. My bank did. And we couldn't move our account over. We lost $1 million line of credit. We laid off 30 people in March of 2009, which is a couple of months after Obama was elected. I was watching him get elected, and I kept thinking, is there anything he can do for me? But I had to rely on myself. And we had contracts, over $11 million in contracts with the U.S. Army and Navy. We'd worked in Pearl Harbor, cleaning up the near the U.S., where the USS Arizona is buried. So we did a lot of work, did a lot of clinical work also, because that's my background. Since then, I've started five businesses. Like the other gentleman mentioned, I've mentored a lot of young people to start their businesses. When you're out of business and you did nothing wrong, and forces in Washington and New York cause your bank to collapse, you kind of sit there and go, I thought I covered all my bases. The point is, you never really cover all of your bases. There's always something that goes wrong. There's always somebody looking to sue you for some reason. There's always somebody, a customer that is not happy or something, So you always have to be on your toes. And
Bill, we're gonna have to leave it there. But it seems like Bill learned some hard lessons in the recession. And if you want to tell us your recession story, how it shaped the life you live a decade later, email us, centralstandard@kcur.org, or send us a tweet. We're @KCURCST. Up next, student life at UMKC. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We're back. This is KCUR Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now UMKC has just brought on a new Dean of Students. Actually, her full title is Vice Provost for Student Affairs, Dean of Students. But the job is an interesting one, especially on an urban campus with a reputation for being a commuter school where lots of students touch down during lives that don't necessarily revolve around the collegiate experience. Her appointment comes at an equally interesting time for the school, with change in the neighborhood as Whole Foods settles in, a recent controversy surrounding new dorms, and in the aftermath of a system-wide reckoning with issues of race. We'll spend the rest of today's show getting to know Sandra Miles and hearing what students, past and present, have to say about their experience of student life at UMKC. Sandra Miles, new Dean of Students, welcome.
Thank you.
So let's start with the idea of student life. What does student life mean to you? What does it encompass?
Well, on a broad scale, it's everything that the student experiences during this time in their lives, right? So outside of the classroom, being involved in clubs and organizations, Greek life, living on campus, but also inside of the classroom, the experience that they're having with their professors. And so in my role, it's my responsibility to make sure that they have the support that they need to be successful so that when they graduate, they can be ready for the world, whole citizens, all of that.
What is it that drew you to a career focusing on student life at universities? Was it something in your own education, your own background?
Definitely. So I went to school with this thought process that I was going to be a hotshot attorney. So my bachelor's degree is actually in political science because I was preparing for that career. But during my time at my institution, I realized that, one, I didn't really have a passion for law, and also I was very actively engaged on my own campus.
What campus was this?
The University of Central Florida. And so when it was my senior year, and I'm a planner, and I realized I had no plan and no prospects, and I was talking to one of my organization advisors, and I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I guess I'll go work for the Justice Department. Like, who knows? And she said, well, you're really involved on campus. You could do this job. My job is a real job. And so I started looking into it and realized that I have a passion for helping people. I come from a family of educators and nurses, and it really just felt like a good fit. And once I got into my graduate program and I saw that it's really not just going to class and going to parties and all those things, but there's actually theory behind the way students develop during this time in their lives. And there are ways that you can help people to be the best version of themselves through sometimes covert means, but usually, you know, them wanting to engage in this experience. It just really felt like the right fit, and haven't looked back.
When you talk about theories about how to help students through this particular time in their lives, can you talk to me about some of the ideas that really connect with you about that? What is it that's special about this time in life, and what are your personal approaches and perspectives on that?
So this is an interesting time for any human being when all their lives, for most people, they've had people telling them what to do. So if they go through the K-12 experience, you know, after second grade, there's third grade. When you get to high school, you kind of have a little bit more freedom, and you may be able to choose which electives you want to take. But for the most part, the core of your curriculum is set for you. And so when you graduate from high school, there's this, what do I do next? There's a lot less structure. And so for people who choose to go to college, there's still some structure there, but there's a whole lot more freedom. And so helping a person navigate through that, this time where, you know, everyone, there are people who are giving them guidance, but no one is telling them exactly what to do or how to do it.
And no one can.
And no one can. And so we have expectations for their behavior, but that's life. There's expectations for anyone's behavior. There are speed limits on the highway. But for the most part, they still make their own choices. And so we help them navigate through what that means to have your own choices, and how to feel more confident in making choices for yourself, how to take responsibility for your own actions, things like that. And so as it relates to my own personal approach, one of my favorite theories is the theory of student involvement. Shocker. And that really focuses on the idea that our most valuable resource on a university campus is a student's time versus, you know, their money or things like that. And so helping them to manage their time, helping them to think about how they use their time, and helping them to use their time in ways that are beneficial to them, but also beneficial to their campus, to their community. To me, that's exciting because those are things that they will carry with them for the rest of their lives.
How do you convince students on a campus that does have a reputation for being more of a commuter space than a residential space? How do you convince people to spend that time on campus, to invest that time in the school rather than in family or off-campus jobs, activities, interests?
Well, first, it's more about figuring out what they care about and what they're passionate about, because you can incentivize different things and say, if you come to this, you might win a TV, right? But for people who already have a TV, that's not necessarily important. Or if they really need to go to work, they're not going to miss time off from work for the opportunity to maybe win something.
So at least hopefully not.
Hopefully, right. So really it's about, one, keying into who they are as individuals, which can be difficult when there are so many individuals, but really focusing on what they can gain from it, but also what they can contribute to the community is usually the way that that has worked for me in terms of reaching large audiences, because most of us, and I don't know if this sounds naive, but most people really do want to contribute. They want to be seen as important and that what they do matters. And so when you can show them that we notice when you're not here, it matters to us that you're engaged. We have, you know, fun activities to keep you happy, but we also have opportunities for you to make a difference. That tends to be a way to start building that bridge to show them that this isn't just a place where you go to class and go home. This is a community that you're a part of, and that if you're not engaged with it, it's not as great as it could be.
You're coming to UMKC from a school in Indiana. Tell me about that school.
Well, it's a part of the Indiana University system. It's one of the smaller campuses, though. And so that student population was also highly commuter. Most of the students have a rural background. And so that was actually kind of where I got my experience with connecting with students in a different way, because they were mostly living with their family, so that was important. They were working, and so we couldn't interfere with that time. And so tapping into what mattered to them was much more important than just saying we had great programs and that they should be happy to come on our bouncy house or hear from this speaker.
Can you tell me about a situation? I mean, I'm guessing that what was important to many of them was a farm somewhere off campus, if a lot of them were coming from rural backgrounds. Mm-hmm. How do you tap into that importance of something that is not necessarily part of campus life and bring that into their own student experience? Can you give an example?
Sure. So we actually did have a lot of students who were trying to get away from farm life, but for those who had that as their knowledge base, we helped them to see that running any type of organization, whether it's a farm or a business, took a certain amount of skills. It took leadership skills. It took communication skills. It took math skills. And so not necessarily focusing on the location specifically, the farm, the family, but showing them what skills they were developing, what skills they already had that they were bringing to the table. That was what was really important.
So what about UMKC will be kind of similar, and what will be a whole new challenge for you?
Well, definitely the highly commuter population will be very similar, and making sure that we are connecting to students at a deeper level than just, you know, having attractive programs. What will be new and different is the capacity, right? There's just much more students on our campus. So that brings more variety in what they care about and issues. Having campus housing will be different, because we did not have on-campus housing at my previous institution, although we were engaged with off-campus housing. So the topic of housing in and of itself will not be new, but the different challenges that come from students actually living where they go to school is just different.
And that is really not how most of the community thinks about UMKC, as one with a residential experience that some students do participate in. Can you talk to me about the people who are part of that residential experience at UMKC and how you think about that?
Well, I mean, we have an incredible staff that works really hard to create an experience for our students so that they are not just, you know, living somewhere, but actually creating a life. They have activities, they have opportunities to be leaders within their halls. And then we try to make sure we have programs outside of housing that for our students, so that our students won't get bored and maybe get into trouble. So for us, it's about creating a whole campus experience. And our housing staff just does an amazing job of keeping track of what's important to our students, getting to know the students, not just having them be a number, but creating a community.
Does UMKC want to be more of a residential school?
Well, I definitely know that is a growing priority for a variety of reasons. I mean, where we are in the neighborhood, for example, it's difficult for some students to be able to afford to live in some of the neighboring communities. And so just as a means of being really proactive and actually serving our student population, it would be helpful for us to have additional housing options for our students who don't want to commute.
You would imagine that dorm rates would be lower than rent in the surrounding area.
Yes. the surrounding area, I mean, it's a beautiful area for sure, but it does bring its own set of challenges.
There was some controversy with the new dorm having leaky pipes and so forth. Students had to move out. That is maybe not a great start in all of this. How do you bounce back from that?
Well, we're working on making sure that we can be as transparent as possible. We're coming up with plans to that we, once everything is solidified, that we would openly discuss with our students. And then being proactive and making sure that we're inspecting our units and following up with insurance claims and different things like that, because it's catching all of us off guard, right? These are fairly new buildings, and we really just want to make sure that we are being supportive to our students, understanding what they must be going through with being asked to move. But for us, the bigger thing is, while we never want to inconvenience our students, we have to place their safety as a priority. And so it would have been much worse to keep them in a situation where they potentially were not safe versus inconveniencing them at that time.
Well, Sandra Miles, stay with me, okay?
Okay.
If you are a UMKC student now or have been in the past, there's still time to call 816-235-2888. Tell us what student life means to you at an urban commuter school and ask Sandra Miles your questions. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. You're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman here on KCUR's Central Standard with UMKC's new Dean of Students, Sandra Miles. And we're wondering whether a thriving campus life is important to students at UMKC, students past or present, and if so, how the school should be fostering that. Hi again, Sandra.
Hello.
I spoke with a UMKC alum about his experience at the school the other day, and when I asked him if he was surprised that someone's whole job was to think about student life, he responded with a resounding yes. And I think that's because, you know, with an experience that revolved around jobs and friends who came from high school and were going through this process together more than connecting on campus, the idea of student life just didn't really seem to resonate with him as part of what UMKC had been about.
Mm. Well, that's certainly unfortunate. I think part of it, though, is sometimes we're so good at being the support system that that it may go unnoticed because it's a pretty large enterprise, right? So you have counseling services, services for students with disabilities, testing services, multicultural student services, student involvement, student activities, which I think for some people when they hear student life, the only thing they think about is student activities. And so if they didn't go to the movies on campus or the whatever outside Union Fest, right, they may think, oh, well, I didn't participate in student life. But they don't realize that everything they did, the student union, going to have something to eat at the dining hall, like all of that is a part of student life. And so I think some of it has to do with us maybe being a little bit more vocal about how much support we're offering to students. But then also with connecting with students and figuring out, okay, well, if Union Fest isn't your thing, or if you didn't go to Sweeney Recreation Center, what are you interested in? How can we be more engaged with you so that you can feel like you're having a life at UMKC?
Part of what he was saying had sort of shaped his experience as a student, even as a student, like in class. Mm-hmm. Something like a group project, finding the time to get together when it's not primarily a residential school. Mm-hmm. If you're not just all in the dorms in the evenings, finding that time where you can all connect, that time and space. Mm-hmm. Is that part of your challenge?
I mean, it really is. It's just a real life challenge, and not just helping students find time and space, but even in my own job, there are so many meetings that I'm expected to attend, and finding that time. There are times when I'm only in my office for like 40 minutes in an entire day because I'm walking around campus going to meetings for the rest of the day. And so I end up having to, even though a standard work day is like 8 to 5, I end up working longer than that just so I can read all the emails, respond to the voicemails and different things like that. So I think even though it feels like a challenge, it's really a preparation opportunity for students when they're like, okay, we have to get this done. There's going to be this expectation. Sometimes it will require late nights or longer hours than you want, but it really is a part of preparing a person, not just for the workforce, but for the world. Because if they, once they start in their full-time career, they may decide they want to join community service organizations or be a part of boards, and then they have to manage that time because everyone will have different jobs and different things like that. So I can understand seeing that as a challenge, but honestly, I also see it as more of an opportunity for students to be creative and start developing those skills that they're going to need.
What's your sense, though, of what students at UMKC expect of a student experience?
Well, I'm still learning that. So my first day was August 1st. I've been going around and meeting with a lot of different student groups, and I'm continuing to meet with students as organizations, but also as individuals. And they're giving me their own feedback that they do want to have an experience that feels fun. They also want to have an experience that feels more like a family. They want to get to know their faculty members. They want to be able to reach people, to know who the people are, to communicate if they have an issue. When I was interviewing for my position, I was surprised when part of my interview process was meeting with a group of students. And so I asked them, I said, what do you expect for someone in this type of position that I'm applying for? And they said to me that they had never met a vice provost or vice chancellor, vice anything. And so they were just excited to have that opportunity. And I think helping students connect and understand how to build bridges, tear down barriers, and different things like that. Because the reality is, all of the vice chancellors that I've met so far are very open and welcoming and happy to meet with students. But it could have just been a disconnect that the students didn't know who to call to make an appointment. The vice chancellors don't know that there's a perception that they're untouchable. And so kind of breaking down those barriers and helping people connect, I think, is part of it.
Yeah, I remember just the idea of, for a student, the idea of these grown-ups, I mean, I know a lot of students at UMKC mm-hmm. are grown-ups in their own right, but a lot of students are still in that developing mm-hmm. stage and think of, people with important-sounding jobs as untouchable.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so for me, when I meet students, as I've been for the last couple of weeks, I introduce myself as Sandra, not because I don't respect the title that I have and not because I didn't work hard for my doctorate degree, but because it helps me to meet them on a certain level. And honestly, most of those students still don't feel comfortable just calling me Sandra. They're calling me Dr. Miles. And I'm not going to, challenge them on that. If that's what they want to do, that's fine. That's an accurate way to identify me. But just kind of being visible in just in this short time, I've noticed is a big difference for them. And yesterday, as a matter of fact, I was about to go to a meeting, and it would have been probably faster if I would have just walked to the meeting. But I saw a group of our student leaders getting on a golf cart to go to another building, and I asked for a ride. And that was an opportunity for me to chat with them for 2 or 3 minutes and to let them know that I'm happy to do that.
Are these the covert means that you mentioned earlier?
Sometimes, but you can't give away my secrets.
So at the flagship campus in Columbia, there were some really highly publicized issues of race. Students mm-hmm. of color and Black students in particular facing overt, really disturbing levels of antagonism. Mm-hmm. I'm sure everyone remembers that. How does something like that within recent memory affect how you approach this job and this place?
First, being an African American woman, I understand the emotional impact that can have when you believe that you're not welcome in a space, and not just by individual people, but by the system itself. And so I try to approach my work first with empathy, because I'm an African American woman, but that doesn't mean that I've experienced every form of discrimination. And so when I interact with students who have experienced discrimination that is different from my own, not trying to play the oppression Olympics and see who's had it worse, but just understanding that being discriminated against is bad regardless of who the target is. And remembering that as we think through policies, as we think through processes. When I have a student who comes to me, being willing to ask more questions than just what is the problem, but how are you experiencing this problem? Who do you feel comfortable going to? That's one of the reasons why I'm really trying to tie in more of the work of our Multicultural Student Affairs Office, not just within that office, but across campus, because we can't have a situation where our students of color only feel comfortable going to one office. That means they're not comfortable at UMKC. And so we have to, I love starting places. So if the African American Student Union is where a student feels at home first, I think that's amazing. I think that's great. But that has to be a starting place. Eventually, by the time they graduate, I want them to feel comfortable going to any organization's event, going to every single office. And we have to do work on the front end to make sure that not just our students feel comfortable, but that if we have a student of color or a Muslim student or an LGBT student show up in a different office outside of my division, that the faculty and staff in those areas also feel comfortable engaging with that student.
How, have you already had conversations along these lines with faculty or with students?
We are starting to have those conversations, and I have had quite a few conversations with our director of Multicultural Student Affairs about ways to integrate her in more conversations and getting her out and more visible and more present on campus, because that is really important.
In the short time you've been here, have you had as much opportunity to talk with students as you want? Is there a conversation you've had that's given you something to think about?
I've had a lot of conversations that have given me a lot to think about, and I haven't had enough of them, though. I am definitely looking for more ways to continue to connect with students. One of the things that I am working on is trying to schedule some time, and I'm really just waiting until classes start to figure out peak times when students are on campus. I want to have open office hours because, as I said, my schedule fills up and I'm all over campus. And so if a student comes and, like most students will do, like whenever it pops into their head, they might go to my office and ask to speak to Sandra or Dr. Miles or, you know, whoever, and I won't be there. And so I'm working on having at least one day a week where no appointment is necessary and I'm just going to be in my office available for students. But then also, once the semester starts, I'm going to try to actually go out to a lot of student events, if they're willing to have me come to their meetings, different things like that, so that they can see that it's not just a title, but it's a human being who actually does care.
How does student life at UMKC spill out into city life in Kansas City, just given how intertwined the university is with the fabric of the city and its own neighborhood?
Well, from what I've gathered so far, our students are very engaged with community service. They really do enjoy going to local sporting events. And so every aspect of being kind of in the center of the city just spills out. And our students are, being that they are highly commuter, they are living their lives in the city. And for us, it's a matter of making sure that they understand what responsibility that means, what it brings to them as being a representative of UMKC. But also,
you do think of their lives outside the school that way?
Definitely. They are a student wherever they go, right? So if they go to Thailand and win some major award, the headline is going to say UMKC student wins an award in Thailand. But also, if they are at the local mall and they're stealing, the headline is going to say UMKC student caught stealing. And so this is a part of their life, and we want them to understand that we feel like it's a very important part of their life, and we want to be very engaged with their life. But it doesn't end just when they're on campus.
Off topic, but what's your favorite thing you've done in Kansas City since arriving here?
So I have... I'm a vegetarian, and I've been told that I can't exist in Kansas City because of the barbecue. So one of my favorite things I've done is I've been to, am I allowed to say the name, Char Bar, because they have barbecue jackfruit. And it makes me feel like I can take my friends and they can have meat and I can have my vegetarian barbecue. So that's been my favorite so far.
Cool. Well, Sandra Miles, stay in touch with us, and our time is up, but thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you.
Sandra is the new Provost for Student Affairs, Dean of Students at UMKC, and that's a wrap for today's show. You can catch any of the conversations you might have missed or grab links to send to friends at kcur.org/centralstandard. If you missed Monday's discussion about gun violence in Kansas City, that is worth a listen for sure. kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, education these days is full of acronyms, and if you're still talking about STEM, we have a newsflash. Now they're talking about STEAM, that has arts, or STREAM, which has reading. So basically, school. More on that tomorrow at 10. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Suzanne Hogan, and Kathleen Pointer. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.